Man, there's so much I want to say, just in terms of thanks and for having us and how happy we are to be here and the camaraderie I feel like we have as a fellow Reformed Baptist church up in around Birmingham area. But everything that I say right now is just going to cut into how much time I have to get through as much as I want to get through, because we're trying to cover a big subject in a short amount of time. So I'll try and save most of that for tomorrow, but thank you so much for having us. We have felt so welcome. We pray for you guys regularly, and I know you pray for us, which is really neat to like meet a church that you regularly pray for and finally get to meet. But you guys come up on my phone, and we pray for you guys, and really appreciate Shane a lot, and happy that we've gotten to... All right, I just need to cut myself off, all right, and get into this. So I have way too much material to get into. If you knew how much I was attempting to cover, you probably wouldn't let me start. So very honored to be here, and... The title that I have for these, which you've probably seen, is The Anabaptist, the Junk Drawer of the Reformation. And I know that sounds pejorative when you hear it. You hear junk and you're like, oh, he's saying they're all junk. And it's not meant to be derogatory. So I'll explain what that means. We're going to do a general overview of the Anabaptists. We're not going to have time to get into each individual dance or group. We're going to sort of dance between going over what they were in the 16th and 17th century as they arose, and what they have become now, because it's not exactly the same thing. It was pretty broad, that category was pretty broad, and it has now narrowed quite a bit to a more definable tradition, I think you could say. So my argument that I would make is that then they were the junk drawer of the Reformation. That's what they were, and they have since become a group of pietistic monks. Modern-day pietistic monks, a holiness-type movement, which is part of what they were, but it has narrowed to be that almost exclusively. So there's a broadness of who was considered Anabaptist in the 16th century, but it has since developed into this identifiable, more narrow tradition. And we're condensing this into 2.5-3 lectures, but this legitimately, I mean, it could be an entire semester covering, honestly, even one group of them. Let alone the whole group. But the history is super, super interesting. First time I gave these lectures, I got some criticism from a Mennonite guy, or at least he was raised Mennonite. I don't know if he was still Mennonite, but he was associated with Mennonite somehow. And he was like, well, you didn't give enough detail about each specific group. Or, you know, I was like, that's just impossible. I mean, the task at hand is not to tell you the idiosyncrasies of each little group. That's impossible, because they're endless and always interesting, but you can spend so much time on it that you could never get through them all. And you couldn't keep track of it all anyway, because it all starts to blend together. So we just don't have that kind of time. We're going to have to do a high-level overview with some of the interesting details sprinkled in that give you an idea of the character of what the Anabaptists are like or were like. So my task tonight is going to be to cover the Anabaptists, but not go into that sort of detail. And it is something I have a vested interest in. It's something that I continually study and put into because I got into this subject more because I was born into it. I was born into an Anabaptist group. I was raised in it. I was a voluntary member of it, of an Anabaptist church, until I was about 28 years old or so, right after my first daughter was born, and it was like, all right, we can't raise our kids on this. So, like any other particular or peculiar religious group, there's really no better education about them than having lived among them, being a part of them by conviction. You know, a guy that comes out of the Mormon church has a better feel for what they're like. You know, we can study them on paper, but they know what it's like to be Mormon. And so they can kind of convey that sort of thing to people that only study them on paper. So that's sort of what I'm hoping I can do for the Anabaptists or about the Anabaptists. Now, the best known groups in terms of the Anabaptist groups that you've probably heard of would be the Mennonites, the Amish, and the Hutterites are probably the big three. In terms of, you've heard the names, most likely. I wasn't a part of any of those. I was part of one of the branches called the Apostolic Christian Church. And there are 7 primary groupings for the Anabaptists now, the tradition. Some of these are sort of like the OG guys. There's the Swiss Brethren, or the Mennonites. We'll talk about them. They're some of the original groups. They're also now the broadest group, so you can have some very liberal Mennonites that are almost like hippie types, peaceniks, and they like the pacifism of it, but they're also very liberal. It's strange. And then you can have some that are all the way on the other spectrum where they're old order Mennonite. And they're very similar to the Amish that way. And you'll find most of these in the Midwest and Pennsylvania. You'll see a lot of them in the Midwest, all of them, because they're all German. It's all Swiss German background. And that's where they settled in the U.S. So there's a lot of them in Pennsylvania and throughout the Midwest. And then the Hutterites, they're another group. They are more influenced by the Moravian world, the pietistic world, the radical pietism that arose. They prefer to be in sparsely populated countryside. They're very rural, and you'll see that amongst all of them. They're very rural, but they like to be in the sparsely populated areas. Presently, they're mostly located in northern places like the Dakotas, a little bit in Wisconsin, Montana, and then north of that into Canada. And like any good red-blooded American, I have no idea about Canadian geography. Like, I can't tell you anything about Canadian geography. So whatever is north of Montana and the Dakotas into Canada, that's where they are. They're sprinkled in there. And then there's the Low Russian or the Russian Low German Mennonites, which is, I mean, they're still the same branch, but they split off and immigrated into Russia at the invitation of Catherine the Great because she wanted German farmers to come in, and they felt comfortable there because they didn't have to serve in the military, and then that changed like 100 years later, and so they shifted. So they're Mennonite, but they're like another branch of the Mennonites. So it's a little bit confusing, but they came from Ukraine, not technically Russia, but Ukraine, which is part of Russia. But they have largely dissipated. They're not a very prominent group. Then there's the Amish. Everybody's heard of the Amish. And the Amish have six main branches, actually. And they range in strictness and tradition and how strict they are about use of technology and that sort of thing. And they do not all get along at all. These six branches don't. They're also concentrated in Pennsylvania and in the Midwest. The fifth branch is the Brethren, sometimes called the German Baptists, sometimes called Dunkers, sometimes just referred to as Old Order. These guys developed in Germany. They have some sects amongst them, different groups amongst them that have split up. They don't all get along either. Again, there's a little bit of a range in terms of how traditional they're going to be. And they are also concentrated in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, things like that. And then the sixth branch would be the Apostolic branch, the Apostolic Christian branch. That's the one that we came up in. There's the American branch that is sort of like the original, and then there's what's called the Nazarene branch, and they have more in Canada, and they have a more of the Eastern Europe influence, and there's some reasons into that that's pretty interesting. But when they came to the U.S., they got a bunch of Amish Mennonite converts, and they were even called the New Amish for a while. But it is a distinct tradition. They've had a multiplicity of splits over things. I can tell you a little bit about those at some point, but they're mostly concentrated throughout the Midwest as well. And just think Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Iowa, stuff like that. But all of these have places that they've gotten to randomly, even throughout the world, but in terms of where they're concentrated, it's mostly Midwest. And then the last one is the Bruderhof group. And it's a really small group. They are distinctly Anabaptist. They developed really late, coming out of in the 20s, 1920s. They developed, and they had all this association with the Hutterites, but then they had a few differences. But they live very communally. They look like Anabaptists. They talk about Anabaptists. They have a distinct Anabaptist tradition. They're not so closed off to the world. I mean, you can find a YouTube channel and learn all about the Bruderhof, which I'm not very familiar with them in general, but they make their stuff accessible. They have a publishing house, and they are distinctly Anabaptist. So even though they're not super well known, I think they fit in one of the categories, and I think it's fair to put them in there. So there are, amongst these seven branches, though, there are commonalities and there are distinct differences across all the groups. And the idiosyncrasies between them are just, they're unending, because each one has so many idiosyncrasies that are both silly and interesting. And they're kind of interesting because they are so silly, or they're so arbitrary. You know, they just make things up and it becomes a thing for them. It is this thing that they hold to tenaciously. There is, even though there's that difference amongst them, though, there is a thematic character across all of them. So I use the analogy of like tie-dye shirts. No two tie-dye shirts are the same. Each one has its own colors, kind of its own patterns. But if you line up a group of tie-dye shirts and you stand back, you're like, I mean, it's a style. It's tie-dye. It has a character, you know. You can pick it out. That's what the Anabaptists are like amongst all their groups. No two are exactly the same, but you see a style, a theme across them. I don't want to spend like too much time telling stories of like what our life was like, but I do want to give you at least some idea of a few of the things that gives you a glimpse into this. So like all of our pastors, they weren't called pastors, they were called ministers, and they were all laymen. None of them were trained. They didn't receive inside training or outside training. I mean, it was very much discouraged. So they were all laymen. You only have one elder per church, and the rest were ministers. Their ecclesiology is a little bit screwy. When the minister gets up to preach for each service, there'd be a morning service, a lunch, and then a lunch after lunch service. The minister would just open the Bible and he'd say, "Well, my eyes have fallen upon such and such," and he would read that text and preach from it. And so every single sermon was unplanned, and its content was extemporaneously preached, which I don't want to be like insulting, but you don't learn anything hardly at all. I mean, you hear a lot of stories. You hear a lot of just random thoughts that this person has, and sometimes they're kind of biblical and sometimes they're not. And it's just very, very, very poor preaching and teaching because of that. The men and women will sit in separate seating, so it's segregated by men and women. There's no jewelry allowed, including wedding rings. Some of those they're pushing the limits. Some of them are starting to wear jewelry outside of church or outside of Sundays. Some will wear wedding rings, you know, every day but Sunday at this point. But, you know, the most distinct will not. The men generally would wear dark suits with white shirts. Sometimes if you were outside of church, it'd be khaki pants. Ties, they always wear ties, usually a dark tie. Not colorful, not patterns. I used to buy my suits and that sort of thing at Goodwill. I just got, you know, thrift store suits and stuff. And I got visited at my home by a brother who, I mean, my dress was not conforming enough. It's the sort of thing that you'll get talked to about, you know, if you're not looking the part. It's not like the rules are laid out either. It's just you learn it. You just live in it and learn it. And I'll talk about that more later. The women would wear their hair up. They would generally keep it in a bun. They would wear head coverings. So there was a little one that kind of looks like a little doily that they would wear most of the time. If you're really holy, you'd wear it around the house. You only take it off to shower. And then they had kind of a longer one that they would put on for church service. Facial hair was banned. It was always banned. Mustaches, everything, totally banned. Sports were banned. You couldn't play in any organized sports. If you did either one of those, they wouldn't even baptize you, couldn't be a member. They did just recently start allowing facial hair. At least part of the church did. Started allowing facial hair, so that's changed. Marriage is said to be by faith, so there's no dating at all, and you just put in a marriage proposal, and you submit that to your elder, and that elder calls her elder, and that elder will say, you know, deliver it to her in some form or fashion. Sometimes, like, you know, are you willing to get married? And they'll pray about that, and then, are you willing? Okay, here's the name of the person that's proposing, and then she'll, you know, deliver the message to her elder, who delivers to his elder, who calls him. So I proposed to my wife through my elder, who happened to be her elder, but it was a mess. So that's the way the marriages kind of work. And they're generally really short engagements, maybe like 3 months or something. Big weddings, though, everybody comes. It's just part of the church service. So our wedding had like 1,500 people at it, I believe. And our reception was 800-something people. And you just stand there and you go through, everybody goes through a line and greets you. I mean, some of these things are changing, you know, a little bit here and there. But that's how it was. And the marriage is very, very highly esteemed. Like, that is, you know, if you're 25 and single, then, you know, something went wrong. You're over the hill. It's that kind of attitude about it. Oh, they do greet with a holy kiss still. I think COVID has probably slowed that down a bit, but they've greeted with a holy kiss from the beginning, men with men, women with women. Every time you see somebody at church, every time you go to their house, you greet with a holy kiss, you shake their hand, you say greetings when you leave, you shake their hand, greet him, say farewell. My uncles still do it, you know, all our family stuff. Farewell, brother, greetings, brother, stuff like that. So never quote me on this out of context, but I have literally kissed hundreds of men. So it sounds weird, but it's true. Their church discipline. Yeah, yeah. scratch that. The church discipline is like their grossest abuse. And this is something that has developed as part of the Anabaptist tradition. They will excommunicate if you come in repentance for a sin that they think is serious. You are excommunicated and you rarely get back in. I mean, it's hard to get back in after you've been excommunicated. Usually if you're young, you have a better chance. But if you've done something, and even if you're the one bringing it forward saying, I've done this, I'm repentant, I'm sorry, you can get excommunicated for it. Again, something that's changing a little bit, but traditionally that's the way it's been. And it is a horrific abuse of the church. A really, really bad thing. Hard to get membership back. You would automatically lose your membership, too, if you married outside of the church. If you don't marry a member of the church, you automatically lose your membership. You're just out by default. They do communion once a year. They forbid it at any other church. My dad even still took a long time, I think, to take it. It was so ingrained in him and from his mom. Like, you don't take it communion anywhere else. I think it was a long time before he felt comfortable taking communion at another church. And you get that feel, you know, it just gets built into you. My wife's church growing up, they didn't take communion for years. No Lord's Supper for years because there was, and it was just a tiny little church that met in a hotel room, something like 12 to 15 people. And there was enough dissension in there because one brother didn't like what your mom's peacock bangs or the TV in your basement. And that was enough to have no Lord's Supper. So that's the sort of thing that can be a big deal enough to upset the church. Anabaptists have historically been against like new forms of technology. It's a trait that you'll see amongst them. It's at least discouraged, or you're more admired for not having it. You know, some of them will outright ban it. Some of them are just kind of like, it's discouraged. Like, you'll never be serving in the church if you have a TV in your house. So a lot of them kind of like, at least the way we grew up, they found ways to hide their TVs here and there. So it was never banned outright in ours, but it's discouraged. It's preached against. You're looked down upon. I remember hearing a sermon about a guy, a minister that bought a new van and had to pay extra money to have the DVD system taken out. And that was like, ooh, so holy. Great. You could just not use it, but I guess pay money to get it out to make a point. A lot of them don't have the internet or TV still. When phones were becoming common, a lot of them were against phones, at least in our church. And I don't mean cell phones. I mean like literally telephones. Like my grandma and grandpa had the kind where you pick it up and you speak into the thing and you hand crank it. They had that on their wall for years. Now, they did have an updated rotary phone eventually, but they also left that one up. And for, I guess, young people that don't know what a rotary phone is, it's one of these things. If you ever, I guess it goes this way, but yeah, you can Google it. When cars came out, they were against cars, you know. They were against that. Even in our church, in the I think 19th century still, when lightning rods were common on houses, they were against lightning rods because it was like, you know, you're not showing faith that God won't burn your house down through lightning. So Yeah, I could go on and on and on with these stories. And you could do that in any church. Any of these churches, you could go on and on with these sort of stories amongst them. And my church that I grew up in, I say my church, right? The church we grew up in, much like a lot of the other Anabaptists, they haven't been able to totally avoid the influence of the modern age and modern American evangelicalism and some of the weaknesses with that. They have tried. They do try and shield their people for it. The more Anabaptist they are, the more secluded they'll be, the more they can maintain that distance. But they're not all able to do that. So some of those more ridiculous items have either gone away or it's a thing of the past, or they've begun to fade in some of the local churches. But a lot of it only in recent years. And in a way, I think I can say I'm appreciative of my upbringing. I told Shane, this is like therapeutic for me in a lot of ways. But I've grown to be more appreciative of that because it has made me more appreciative of biblical doctrine and biblical church polity, like seeing why that matters and how it can matter, and especially the gospel. Because it's when you're deprived of those things and then you come into them and you see the clarity of it and it changes your life, I mean, it just, you care a lot more. So I've kind of likened it to a man that's lost in the desert that comes out and suddenly he has daily access to a water fountain. Like, he doesn't get sick of how wonderful that is. You know, it matters. So if upon hearing that list, though, you're thinking, well, that doesn't really align with the Anabaptist that I've heard of, then don't be surprised by that, because
I mean, for us, facial hair was banned, but and having stubble even would be viewed as rebellious. But then Amish, on the other hand, like you're traditionally, you have to have a beard. Not a mustache, but at least a beard. If you're married, you grow a beard. So it's almost like a requirement. It's part of their tradition. So each one is very different. Each one can have very different things. So there's this, I think there's this fascinating intersection of cultures between the Anabaptist and Eastern European immigration in the late 19th and 20th century. The influence there, their perspective on the acceptability of a mustache, which sounds funny, it's like, what? Who cares? But there was this association with the mustache of the military, so if you're a pacifistic, or once they had become pacifistic, it was like, well, you can't even have the thing that we associate with the military, and the Eastern European immigrants still had them as just part of their culture, and that became a conflicting issue. It led to church splits. I mean, our church split over whether or not you could have a mustache, the one we grew up in. It's crazy. So there's this, we don't have really time to go into that, but it's super interesting. So here's the point I'm really getting at, though. Contrasting my upbringing to something like the Amish with the facial hair thing, each Anabaptist group tends to have their own set of idiosyncratic traditions. Very, very idiosyncratic traditions. There are similarities amongst the traditions even. Like, you see the same ideas sort of behind them. Like, oh, it's because they want to be separate from the world. Or, oh, they don't like technology. But each, it works its way out in different ways. But there's a... there's a unifying characteristic, you know, that you see across these Anabaptist traditions, but none of them are identical. But the thing about them is that the idiosyncratic traditionalism, like that is a hallmark of being Anabaptist, idiosyncratic traditionalism. And it's the first characteristic of what I would name for the Anabaptists. There are odd practices against or amongst each group without much connection to each other. Or like the Catholic is in the historic church, I mean small c Catholic. And there's no real tie to scripture itself. It's just a thing that they care about, that they've decided to care about because they've invented these laws. So whatever it is that they develop, wherever their tradition goes, whatever idiosyncratic tradition that they've invented, they will hold to it with a tenacity, an absolute tenacity, to the point where it to not do it is considered rebellious and proud, which means you might not be saved at all. And you can't maybe be a part of this group, you know, it's a rebellion against authority. So they're very, very pharisaical that way, and the idea that they make up traditions and elevate them to the law of God. They treat them the same way as the law of God. And I'll explain a little bit why later. But a lot of Anabaptist churches are drowning their people in Pharisaism. I mean, there's no real better way for it. If you read the Pharisees, you're like, these are proto-Anabaptists in a lot of ways. Make this thing up and care about it to the death, that sort of thing. The traditions they make up get elevated, yeah, like I said, to the same law of God. They're enforced by the leaders as if they're equal to God's law, and rebellion against those by not doing them, by not conforming, then you're rebelling against the teaching authority of the church, and that's a big taboo. And it's all really about social taboos. It's all about the social pressure within the group itself, because they can't like open a book and say, see, you broke rule number 5B, It's not like that. It's like you just know it. You just do it. You learn it. So doing so is like a sign that you've maybe lost your salvation. And that's another defining characteristic of the Anabaptists, the surety that salvation can be lost. Like they are absolutely sure that you can lose your salvation. I'll talk more about doctrine a little bit later, but they are fiercely Arminian. And they never abandoned the late medieval synergistic semi-Pelagian soteriology of the medieval church. They really haven't. They've essentially tweaked what it looks like, but the idea is exactly the same. It really is. It's faith plus works. And they won't necessarily always say that, but that's what it is. And they will sometimes outright deny it's faith alone. But they definitely wouldn't use the Arminian label for themselves. I mean, Arminians rarely do. But everyone that says, you know, I'm not Arminian or Calvinistic, they're always Arminian. the Anabaptists, though, they would heartily agree with all five Arminian points, like even more than the original Arminians. So the point that they would hold to the strongest, though, is that last one about losing your salvation. Like, that's a big deal to them. In fact, if you hold to a doctrine If that's the only point of Calvinism that you hold to, like in your minds, their minds, you're a Calvinist. So even like those traditional Southern Baptists that are four-point Arminians, but they think you can't lose your salvation, to an Anabaptist, they're Calvinistic. So it's just interesting. And they generally see that doctrine as the root of evangelical error. Like evangelicalism, why it's so weak and the churches are so bad, they see that as the root of it. And part of it is the abuse of it, right? They're not completely off on that. They perceive it as an easy believism, a carnal Christianity stemming from the fact that everybody thinks they can't lose their salvation. And if it is abused, you know, that is what happens. But the odd thing is their pervasive Arminianism is why you see traditionalist Southern Baptists kind of attempting to find unity with the Anabaptists. They don't like the real history of where Baptists came from, so they try and find unity with the Anabaptists. But the genuine Baptist roots, the genuine article, they came from the Puritans. You know, I'm sure you guys have heard this and studied it. The founders of the SBC even were, you know, blatant Calvinists. So before I get too far into this lecture, I want to sort of describe what I'm trying to convey. I don't want to just give like this historical rundown of significant figures and events, though we are going to do a little bit of that. You just have to, and it shapes their history. You know, their trajectory was, I mean, it was kind of set really early on, and it kind of shaped the modern iteration that we find now, although that whole thing was, it was whittled down from what it was. But anybody can read those details, you know, on their own, and I want to do that plus some analysis and diagnosis of it. And I'll tell you now that nearly everything that I say about them, like even the good and the bad things, you know, somebody could fairly respond to that. Well, they'll be like, well, not all Anabaptists. And I'm like, yeah, I know, not all Anabaptists. Yes, you can find a group that's different on this, or they have a slightly different perspective, but this is the general tenor. I'm going to speak of them in the general themes. So I don't want to constantly say like some or many Anabaptists are this way or were this way, but that's going to be the case because there's not absolute unity amongst them. It's general themes. So I'll try to distinguish where I can. And what I hope to leave you with is an understanding of the Anabaptist ethos, like the spirit of the Anabaptist, the character, the thing that, like, you get a feel for what they're like. I don't know what better really to call it, the Anabaptist ethos. I want you to understand, like, the feel of the Anabaptist as a movement and as they exist now, because no two groups of them are the same. They're similar teachings and mentalities and characteristics, some of which I've already described, but we're going to do a bit of history with that too. So let's start there with a little bit of history. It goes back to their arrival on the scene during the Reformation, and that's where my title comes from, the junk drawer of the Reformation. And like I said, it sounds pejorative, and I'm not calling them junk, although even, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily hesitate to do that, but that's not what I mean by that title. It's acknowledging a simple historical reality, and that is, like, if you have that drawer in your kitchen or in your pantry somewhere, you have a drawer where there's just a bunch of stuff thrown into it, and it's filled with these odds and ends, and it's usually really messy, and some of the stuff is useful, some of it you probably should have thrown out before, and, you know, it's just like the thing that unifies it is that you just have no better place for it. Like, it might as well just be in this drawer where sometimes we open it and find this, you know, a pen or a notepad or stamps or, you know, stuff, paper clips, stapler. How often do you use a stapler? I don't know, once a month. Something like that. There's just stuff in there, and then there's probably old things you threw in there just to get it off the counter. Things like that. There's a hodgepodge of clutter in that junk drawer, and sometimes we just call it a junk drawer, and that's what I mean by it. That's where the Anabaptists were in the 16th century. Back then, that's what they were. They're the junk drawer. There's no good category for these other people. All the people considered Anabaptists, this is like, where else do you put them? Because they're not Protestant, and they're not Catholic, and they're not Lutheran. They're not part. They're present in the Reformation, but they're not reforming it, or at least their character of their reform is not like the Reformation reform. So here's a big definition. I'll read this twice because it's so long. But they are the category for all of the miscellaneous sects, radicals, revolutionaries, mystics, spiritualists, apocalyptic preachers, and frankly, lunatics, just straight up lunatics that cropped up in Europe during the confusion that naturally emerged from a rigid and stratified religious socio-economic world that had been turned upside down by the combined forces of the Reformation and the Renaissance. It's a really bad run-on sentence, but I think it captures everything that it was. So I'll read it one more time. The Anabaptists are the category for all the miscellaneous sects, radicals, revolutionaries, mystics, spiritualists, apocalyptic preachers, and, frankly, lunatics that cropped up in Europe during the confusion that naturally emerged from a rigid and stratified religious socioeconomic world that had been turned upside down by the combined forces of the Reformation and the Renaissance. So Europe was turned on its head. The socioeconomic world, the religious world, the Renaissance played a role, the Reformation played a role. There's lots of confusion. National borders are kind of in flux here and there. Influence and power is going back and forth, and it just, all these groups sort of emerge. And there had been a tradition of this sort of thing in the area where they came from, coming out of the medieval world, and they just naturally emerged from there. So remember, there was a broadness back then. Like all those groups, the sex radicals, the revolutionaries, the mystics, spiritualists, you know, they're not all unified, really. There's a broadness to what was considered Anabaptist in the 16th century, but it did later develop into a more identifiable tradition. So if we use the term reformer in like the broadest sense possible, in the sense, just the broad sense of saying like they're changing things, they're trying to change things, then I think then you can say that the Anabaptists are the epitome of reformers, but they're reforming with zeal without knowledge. That's kind of what was going on with them. We as Reformed Baptists come from the Reformation, but we do not find our spiritual forefathers amongst the Anabaptists. That is not our roots. So someone will say, well, then why are you guys talking about it? Why are Baptists talking about Anabaptists? Well, I mean, as you know, we didn't come from it. There's no organic origination from them. We came from the particular Baptists in England, amongst the Puritans. They were separatists. The Anglican Church was all too slow to reform. Puritans kind of formed. The Baptists came out of that under Queen Elizabeth and King James, King Charles. And then in the 20s and 30s, we got a particular Baptist identity, and they fully reformed. You know, they were reforming away from the Church of England once they had some space to do it. And that's where you get your particularly distinct Baptist identity. That's where it comes from. We were Puritan. We are Puritan, Reformed, Confessional, Calvinistic, Covenantal, Congregational, Credo Baptist, obviously. That's who we are. That's what they were. That's where we come from. That, you know, that's our bloodline. The only commonality that we share with the Anabaptists, really, is the Credo Baptist part. You know, they don't baptize infants either. And there is some similarity with the church and state distinction and separation from church and state, where we believe in religious liberty, and that's true, but again, it's different for them. So I say again, they are not, the Anabaptists are not our spiritual forefathers at all. Them as a persecuted religious minority, and I mean, particular Baptists were the same, we wanted the state to get off our back. We don't want the state dictating how the church should act. We don't want them dictating our beliefs and practices, so we share that commonality, but even there, it wouldn't be accurate to say that the Baptists and the Anabaptists shared the same view of the church and state and the civil realm in general. We don't. I would say that the Reformed and the Reformed Baptists particularly too have respect and understanding for its role, whereas the Anabaptists almost think of it as a necessary evil, and a lot of them withdrew from it, like you shouldn't even participate in it. Some still make that argument. So again, given that they're not our spiritual forefathers, why talk about them? Well, in spite of those historical facts about Baptists, we still get lumped together with the Anabaptists. People assume that the Baptist faith was like the flower that bloomed from the seed of Anabaptism and the Anabaptists. And then the Anabaptists sort of disappeared and developed into the Baptists. And that is not the case. That's not true. The Anabaptists were winnowed. You know, they were diminished into a more identifiable group. But they, you know, their more radical factions kind of died off. Their theological and philosophical, the civil, political factions that were more radical did disappear. But the Anabaptists themselves never went away. So we talk about them, even though we're Baptists, we talk about them so that we know why they are not us. And their doctrine and practice in history is not our doctrine and practice in history. We understand that we have a distinct identity, partially because we get accused of having that identity. And it's not true. It's just really bad history. So that's really the second reason that we talk about them, is they're, it's not our history, and people accuse us of that. But some of their characteristics, some of the characteristics of the Anabaptists have become increasingly evident among modern-day evangelicals. It's kind of funny how it works, such as the radical independence from even associations that we practice, a radical type of independence, kind of a disdain for the institutional church that has really cropped up in evangelicalism. People have far less problem today throwing out, or at least completely ignoring, centuries of historic creeds and confessions and historical theology and historical orthopraxy, like the things that we do, the practice. They have no problem ignoring them. You know, every church has its own little statement of faith. So many times when I explain confessionalism to people, I'm like, look, these things are set. We're just putting ourselves in line with the historic Christian faith. And we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Evangelicalism, you know, you don't hear about the creeds. You don't hear about confessions. And what the church has done for 2,000 years doesn't make a huge difference to them. Not necessarily that they get everything wrong, but, you know, there's a radical independence there that we do not share, that the Anabaptists, you can see that amongst them. So even church polity, the mission of the church, church membership, worship, all these things, nearly everything, because of the dearth of historical confessionalism and because of the rampant apostasy of the mainline churches, which even we recognize, yeah, they're almost wholly apostate. In some legitimate ways, I think it's fair to say that the Anabaptists have promulgated their ethos more pervasively into American Christianity than any other Reformation group. And not that they necessarily tried to do that, but it just kind of happened. They didn't necessarily do that themselves because, you know, they pull back from contact with the evangelical world. But still, evangelicalism has been largely Anabaptized, if we could say it that way. They have some of these trends. And then the last thing that I always say about studying them, one of the last reasons, is simply the fact that they are terribly interesting, in my opinion. They really are. And there's no shame in wallowing in just the pure enjoyment of church history and appreciating that sort of thing. I mean, my phone would be nearly empty if we didn't study church history on a regular basis. So let me acknowledge this, too. When it comes to studying the Anabaptists, and if you start doing it on your own at all, there is an issue. Many historians, at least the ones that spend significant time on them, they have like these rose-colored glasses about who they were and what they are now. And they look at them almost like this friendly little group that just does things a little bit differently. And they have these rose-colored glasses, and they're overly favorable to them. You know, they view them as the underdogs in the Reformation, and the underdog is always like, you know, there's a little bit of pull to kind of like and, you know, root for him a little bit. And they view them that way because of the persecution against them, which, I mean, it was legitimately horrible and unjustified. You know, it's terrible what happened to them. But some of these historians then will create an unrealistic picture, and they're overly sympathetic, and they gloss over some of their most significant errors, and they don't give them the critique that they really deserve. And it's, you know, it's a little bit like playing with fire. You just don't understand the danger of the thing that you're talking about. And then other historians will simply like highlight the craziest ones of the bunch and show how nutty that they could be, and then they would just brush past the rest all too quickly. Which, I mean, yeah, it's easy to snipe at them. It really is. It's very easy to do. They produced a lot of low-hanging fruit in which we can criticize them. In my opinion, a select few are worthy of respect, most of them which got killed off pretty early. But there's a select few where you can be like, all right, I mean, no, we don't totally agree with them, but we can see that these guys were brothers in Christ, really. I mean, if you're reading something and the Anabaptists come off looking pretty good, then they're probably, they need harsher judgment. If they come off looking good, the writer is probably not super clear on orthodoxy or their lack of orthodoxy. But if you're reading something and not one of the Anabaptists seems to be a genuine brother in Christ seeking truth, seeking genuine reform, then in that cases, or in those cases, I think there is a call for some more generous analysis on occasion. So It's hard to find a middle ground between those. That's generally what you're going to find in the sources, the secondary sources. So if you read about it, be aware of it. If you're prompted by any of this to start studying them, I guess pay attention to that sort of thing. I'll try and maintain a proper balance as I deal with them. I do feel this innate tug to defend them because of my upbringing. It's like I want to defend them a little bit. It's like if you're a fat person and you, you're a little bit offended when fat people get made fun of, but you'll do it yourself. It's just like not from this source. Like I'll say what they need to hear, not you. I feel that a little bit, and it's I know it's a little bit silly because knowing what I know about their doctrine and their practice, both today and in the past 500 years, I have a near endless list of very harsh criticism and frustrations with them. So I do, I'm tugged both ways, I guess. And I'll be honest, my punitive posture toward them outweighs my defensive posture towards them. I do not have a generally good view of them. And I think that's justified, and I'll try and show you why I think that's justified. Now, with all that being said, let's return to the 16th century. Let's continue getting into the minds of the original Anabaptists. Remember that junk drawer idea, this broad idea. They ranged from these naive biblicists. Again, I don't mean that negatively. I mean, as reform happened, as people came out of the Roman Catholic Church, they're not instantly reformed. They don't instantly know things by leaving the Roman Catholic Church. So there's a lot of naivete that comes from these people that are just getting rid of all that. You know, they're abandoning a tradition, but they don't immediately come into another tradition. So there's some naive biblicists amongst them. And it can range from that to complete kooks, the lunatics, and everything in between. And everything in between that couldn't be fairly called Protestant or Roman Catholic or Lutheran. All those other people, they're kind of grouped together amongst the Anabaptists. And make no mistake, the title Anabaptist was meant as a slander against them. They didn't pick that for themselves. Neither did the Lutherans, neither did the Calvinists. None of those, nobody picks their own label. But it was meant as a slander. It was meant to fearmonger that name Anabaptist. We'll talk about why that became the case in a little bit. It's today if we called somebody a Branch Davidian. I don't know, some of you guys will remember Waco and David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. If you call somebody a Branch Davidian, that people get what that means. You're calling into account a history of a cult and saying these people are cultish. And or Jonestown, Jonestownian. Saying somebody drank the Kool-Aid, that comes from Jonestown where they poisoned the Kool-Aid and all committed suicide. That saying, they drank the Kool-Aid, is they went nuts, they bought into some radical thinking that's crazy. And most of this is because of Munster and the Peasants' War, which, it was political anarchy, and we'll talk about those things, but that's what the label Anabaptist was used as. And by the way, the People's Temple that was led by Jim Jones that eventually culminated in Jonestown and all that that mass murder and that suicide, they claimed to be practicing apostolic socialism, which is still what some of the Anabaptists will say today. They'll call it Christian socialism, or they'll say apostolic. And they had Marxist leanings. So that's interesting stuff. You still see these threads of fanaticism that crop up that find identity in the Anabaptists and in that tradition. I will say this, too. One of the stories, the Munster story that we will talk about in the second session, rivals Jonestown in terms of its shock and its scandal. In fact, saying it rivals, it makes it sound like it's comparable. It blows Jonestown out of the water. It's insane, and we'll talk about it. But the Anabaptists, the socialism and the proto-Marxism amongst Christians, not that they're advocating for the society to be that way necessarily, but the church at least. They claim that to be apostolic. They pull that from having all things in common in Acts 2 and 4, and that's a big part of their identity. In fact, that desire to be apostolic it's one of the defining characteristics. They have this mindset of returning to what they view as this simple golden age, pure church, right after the apostolic era or during the apostolic era. This simplicity of doctrine and life that they perceive existed there. Now, that's false. It didn't there is no golden age in the church. You know, even the apostolic church you see in scriptures, they got some problems that the apostles had to deal with, and that's why we hear about terrible sins in Corinth and then the seven churches in Revelation. You know, there's lots of sin going on. There's no golden age in the church. But they have that sort of idea of the apostolic church, and they like that apostolic idea. In the same case, in some cases, they want to return to a socialistic community that they think existed back then. So they do this. And the Amish and the Hutterites, a lot of them are socialistic within their communities. Sort of communistic, socialistic, it depends what you mean. But, I mean, you can see videos of Hutterites going to their hall, whatever their communal hall is, and getting, like, daily food rations. And the Bruderhof that I talked about, like, nobody gets paid. Everybody works, but they have all things in common. And they call it socialism. And so they have that golden age perception of the church. And you can see it in the name of the church that we grew up in, Apostolic Christian Church. We're the apostles, right? They're trying to articulate that idea. And you would hear them do that. Even when it came to arguing against doctrines that they don't agree with, they would claim, well, we just want a simple faith. You know, that's a simple faith. And they'll accuse you of overly complicating things, overly deep, overly defined doctrine, stuff like that. And as I remember, when I was becoming Reformed, and I was getting a little bit more vocal, I guess, and I was still Anabaptist, I was going there, somebody sat down with me, and they warned me, like, well, you know, I said something about wanting to get into the meat, you know, why all this milk? All you ever hear about is this doctrine of repentance. I mean, there's more to the Christian faith, right? Not that that's unimportant, but let's get past the milk and into the meat. And he's like, well, if you get into the meat, you might get into the bone. And I was like, okay, is that bad? I mean, what's the bone? He never explained to me what it meant. I still have never reached the bone and you know, chipped a tooth or anything on doctrinal bone. So, but that's the idea that was present enough to him for him to sit me down and, like, talk to me about it. Like, stop getting into it too much. Stop getting into doctrine too much. In fact, I mean, there's, in some of them, like, if you bring a Bible to church, or you have, like, a carrying case and you bring it to Bible, it's like, that's a warning sign that person is getting too into Scripture and getting rebellious. Like, what we have, what we've built is not good enough for them. That sort of idea. And I'm not saying that's super prevalent in our church, but it was in some of them. If you brought your own Bible to church, it's like, what are you doing? Like, you reading that a lot? Now, they talk about reading it a lot, but they don't have a high view of Scripture. It's a weird thing about them. They talk about having a high view of Scripture. They don't practice a high view of Scripture because to them, like, everything's gray. You can't understand it. You know, you'll hear them talk about, like, how they barely understand any of it. And the parts that they do understand, though, it's the law. You know, the things they ought to do. This intense literalism on certain things. It's very nitpicky and like, which ones are they going to take literally? Which ones are they going to understand and take very seriously? So I think it's fair to say that they are apostolic primitivists, this idea of being apostolic. Apostolic primitivists, they're trying to recover the primitive apostolic church. That's part of what they view as what they're doing. We're returning to what they were in the apostolic era. But that name, Anabaptist, it was used slanderously amongst the Reformed, and it was used polemically. And if you were not part of the establishment, or if you were doing something that another group didn't agree with, they might call you Anabaptist intentionally to try and harm you, to try and smear you. When the particular Baptist arose in England and they had pamphlets published against them, and they were calling them Anabaptist, and they were trying to imply that this group in England, they're going to try and grow up and they're going to overthrow the king and set up their own community and make us all be Anabaptists. And so they're trying to make the particular Baptist out to be Anabaptists. So when the particular Baptist wrote their first confession in the 1640s, they titled it The Confession of Faith of Those Churches Which Are Commonly, Though Falsely, Called Anabaptist. That's what they titled their confession. We are not Anabaptists. Granted, we are different than you, but we are not Anabaptists. And likewise, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but in the first edition of the Institutes, Calvin had to say that he and the Huguenots, the Reformed in France, were not Anabaptists. He got accused of it, even. And that's obviously not because they were credo Baptist. It's because They were upsetting the established church in France. And so they got accused of being Anabaptists. You know, people were trying to associate them with rebellion and anarchy and upsetting the establishment. So all of that stuff that I just said, like that sort of thing is glamorized in like modern entertainment culture and in our college campuses. But in the Reformation era, in the 16th, 17th century, that sort of thing was despised and it was genuinely feared. Because when that happened, that sort of thing happened, people died. Because when it happened, it created movements and people died. Now, if it happens on a large enough scale today, yeah, it still happens and people will die. But people feared it. It was a thing that could actually happen. So the accusation of Anabaptists was used to incite opposition to some other Reformed-minded groups. It happened to our forefathers. It happened to the Reformed forefathers, even, though not as much. The Roman Catholic Church used them as the example of the, like, this is the logical conclusion of what happens in the Reformation. This is what's going to happen. You might even say that the Anabaptists almost ruined the Reformation. Medieval sacramentalism, Roman Catholic sacramentalism, I say it's like heroin in the sense that the addict, you can't stop an addict cold turkey. It's actually a little bit dangerous. It's somewhat counterintuitive, but you have to wean them off of that. And Europe was like that a little bit with bad religion. You had to wean them off, and it couldn't, unfortunately, it couldn't be immediately reformed. You had to wean this continent off of bad religion. And so some of the reforms took a bit longer, and I think it was necessary that it took a bit longer, not that it was ideal, but that's what happened. So the sacraments, for instance, they don't get fully reformed for about 100 years until after the 95 Theses. It's not until the 17th century that you see the sacraments getting fully reformed. So Luther partially reforms the Lord's Supper, gets rid of transubstantiation. He partially reforms baptism a little bit. He partially reforms church polity. And then the Continental Reformed and the Presbyterians reform it a little bit more. Granted, they bring it along, but it's the particular Baptist that came in and finished the job. I really think we did. We finished the job. We fully reformed all those doctrines, and we got it right, I would argue. So our understanding of consistently fencing both sacraments, we fence them the same way. It's for people that profess faith. You know, it's for believers only. It's a means of grace. Those are Baptist distinctives. Reformed Baptist distinctives. From Luther to the Reformed Baptist, they kind of got closer and closer to the biblical understanding. They finally got there. And that's where I do find a little bit of sympathy for some of these original Anabaptists, because they wanted reform, but they wanted it too quickly in a way that was just unrealistic. I mean, if we're being generous, we might say that they were ahead of their time in small regards, just small regards in terms of like the holiness of what a church is supposed to look like. Like, they understood what they were seeing in Europe. It didn't make sense. Like, these people aren't Christians. Why do you keep calling them Christians? But that sort of shaped their trajectory in a negative way, because they became a holiness movement because of that. But they were demanding this sort of change, and they do deserve credit for seeing the need for that change, but they don't deserve credit for doing it the right way, because they didn't. They didn't get there the right way. They wanted religious liberty, for instance. Immediately, though. They wanted it immediately. It was just never going to happen. You're not going to get rid of sacralism in a state church that fast. It's just not going to happen. Now, you know, how much do you criticize somebody for wanting something too quickly? That's just part of where they deserve a little bit of credit, you know, believing and wanting religious liberty. They wanted separation of church and state. Not necessarily in the secular sense. They didn't want a secular society, but they wanted liberty for themselves to practice their faith as they saw fit. And they were persecuted minorities, so of course they did. You know, any persecuted minority is going to want that. But, and also, in isolated pockets where Anabaptists did get the majority, where they did get in power, and they weren't a minority in this, you know, little pocket, they were not so quick to grant permissiveness in religious liberty at all, religious freedom to others. They didn't practice it themselves when they got the chance. Confessional Presbyterians, like, they take a while, right, to abandon the idea of a state church. It wasn't really until they saw that sacralism was not going to fly in the newly democratic-minded Americas, right? And they finally abandoned it, and they changed the Westminster Confession, sort of, you know, brushed that aside. No more sacralism in the Westminster Confession. We had it right all along, but, you know, they had to change theirs. But I know we can find significant flaws like that for every group of reformers, but the Anabaptists are simply more complicated. and they're more flawed. They have, like I said, a ton of low-hanging fruit by which you can criticize them. Now, generally speaking, in my opinion, I would say they are the most embarrassing aspect of that era. Some of them were not as bad as the rest, but overall, they're still trending negative. There's not a whole lot of good things to look at. I saw one historian raise the question. He said, well, were they heretics? Were they fanatics? Were they saints? And I honestly think the answer to that is heretics, yeah. Yeah, some of them were heretics. A lot of them were heretics. Fanatics, yes, without a doubt. Yes, some of them were fanatics. And then saints, yes, some of them were saints. And you can even have sympathy, especially amongst some of the original ones, because you know they're so untaught themselves. You can understand how they fall for stuff a little bit easier. So that answer, really, it hasn't changed for 500 years. You still see heretics, fanatics, and saints amongst them. Although I think the proportions have changed a little bit. You know, you don't see as many fanatics amongst them anymore because most of them, you know, they got themselves killed or died out sort of naturally. So there's less fanatics that endured. But remember, they're not Protestant. They are not Protestant. They wanted radical change, and they wanted radical change in a good way and in a lot in a bad way, both. But in seeking that change, it's helpful to think of them as like non-magisterial reformers. The reformers we know and love were magisterial reformers. They were doing it in partnership with the secular authorities, the princes, the city councils, the magistrates. And I'm not saying that's ideal, but they were generally right when they were doing it. The things they were pushing for were improvements. And that pushed the Anabaptists to the fringes even more because they have no partnership with any of that. And I'm not saying they're wrong in doing that. I'm just saying this is what happened. And this is a generalization, but the magisterial reformers were thinking in terms of reforming the institutional church and entire nations, bringing nations along, getting them out from under Roman Catholicism. Whereas the Anabaptists are kind of thinking in terms of each individual person and each individual local church being allowed to do as they please and reform as they please. And it's not like one is right and the other is wrong. They're both right in a sense, but it led to different practices, I guess. Now, not because they didn't, it's not that the Anabaptists didn't want large-scale reform or something like that, but they had no confidence in the what they saw as Christendom to do that. They didn't have any confidence in the reformers or the civil authorities or the societies that they saw these reformers operating in. And I think there's reason for that that's understandable, that I'll explain a little bit later, I think, but that's what they saw. And they weren't wrong in seeing, like, these are not a Christian people, necessarily. They weren't wrong in seeing that, or seeing the clergy that is not Christian, acting not Christian. They saw it and they hated it. And they're not wrong in that. But they did have a narrower view that was focused on just them, essentially. They're not looking to change nations and that sort of thing. They were looking to affect their small band of followers. And there were fanatics that wanted to change the, you know, their city and country and eventually the world, but they didn't really last. So as some countries reformed, and the alliances basically of entire countries would switch, the individual people didn't immediately believe good doctrine. The clergy that was like a Roman Catholic priest one day and then a reformed pastor the next, they didn't just become reformed all of a sudden. Some of them were, you know, they weren't converted as Roman Catholic priests, and they did not become converted when the nation around them and the church around them reformed. So that sort of thing, when there's like a 180 that quick, these people weren't getting saved necessarily. So there's still a lot of bad clergy and people that go to state church, you know, they baptize their babies into it, and sacralism. I lay that at the feet of sacralism, really, this state church idea, because these people are viewed as Christians because they grew up in it. But there's not actually a ton of conversion, because that sort of thing takes time. It takes years and generations of preaching the gospel to convert entire nations and an entire continent like that. But the Anabaptists saw that these people aren't actually Christian, and this idea of Christendom is there, and they criticized it. They used it as a point of criticism for the entire reform. Like, they laid it at the feet of the reformed as if the reformed could have done anything about that. They couldn't. You know, you preach the gospel and it takes time. You let the conversions happen. But sacralism is what put that label of Christian on this unchristian world. The state church did that. And the Anabaptists used it as a talking point against them, I guess. Reformed morality and ethics took time to pervade into the church because it has to come from genuine gospel preaching and teaching. That's how you convert a people, not from just forcing it as part of your culture. That doesn't work. So even though they deserve some credit for rejecting immorality that they saw, we have to acknowledge that many of them were unhinged. They were detached from historical orthodoxy, and for that, they deserve scorn. They do. They were detached from historical orthodoxy. And because of that detachment, they fell into severe doctrinal error. And they still have severe doctrinal error. Or it might be better to say, they never abandoned the error, that the heart of the error that came out of the medieval theology, particularly the soteriology of the medieval church. They just never abandoned it. They stopped being Roman Catholics themselves, but the heart of what they believed was the same. They got rid of the Pope and the traditions and the sacraments, but the heart of what they understood of how things worked was the same. I've used this illustration several times, and I think it seems to help people. So all too often, people think of the Reformation as like this linear scale of like the Roman Catholic Church is here, and then the Lutherans reformed it a little bit. And then the Reformed, the Continental Reformed, kind of made more progress. They brought it along. Then the Puritans brought it along even farther. You know, they're reforming it farther. You're getting farther down the line away from Roman Catholicism. But it was the Anabaptists that, you know, it leapfrogged them all. They're the farthest on this scale, the absolute farthest away from Roman Catholicism. They reformed the most. They're the radical Reformation. I don't think that's accurate. I think it's more like a horseshoe. If you think about it like that, you got the Roman Catholic Church, and the Lutherans do reform it a little bit. And the Puritans reform it, and the Continental reform, and I would say even the particular Baptists, they reform it all the way. But the Anabaptists actually come back around. And then they're not that far away. They're different, but they come back around and start mimicking Roman Catholicism and its errors and traditionalism in weird ways that are they're pretty hard to predict. So they traveled the furthest in sense of reformed, but they didn't get the furthest away from the Roman Catholic Church that they're trying to reform from. So if you think about it like a football player, you hand it off and he runs sideways and maybe back into the backfield a little bit. And in the end, you know, he's tackled on the other side of the field, but he's only gained 1 yard. He covered, you know, 50, 60 yards running around, but he doesn't make progress towards the goal. That's sort of what the Anabaptists did. They changed it. They covered a ton of ground. They just didn't make any progress. So it's not that great, you know. You don't get credit for the ground you cover, you get credit for the progress you make, and they didn't. So they weren't the most progressive reformers. They don't make the most progress. They were a bit regressive in terms of their fellow reformers. They were regressive. They parallel Roman Catholicism in odd ways. They continue this medieval anti-clericalism and holiness movements that came from this area of Swiss Germany that traditionally happened in the 12th and 13th centuries. If you've read about the Henricians or the Petrobrusians, there's an anti-clericalism movement, and they're really in that vein a little bit. So they're anti-Roman Catholic, but they're not making progress in terms of biblical doctrine a whole lot. They have a similar level of unbiblical idiosyncratic traditionalism as Roman Catholicism, but without the Pope, without the sacramental system. But they're both inherently Pharisaical. The Roman Catholic Church and Anabaptists are inherently Pharisaical. So think of it this way, like Roman Catholicism, they took this empty black box, they got a black box, you could put anything in it, and they filled it up over time with all sorts of man-made traditions and heretical inventions. And they just put them in this black box, and then they get out a label maker and they put this big label, they slap a label on it that says tradition on this black box. And you can put anything in it. And they didn't have to defend the traditions in the box. They defend the box itself as tradition. So if you can defend tradition, then whatever's in the box is by default defended. So that's what they did. You know, you can add or take away from that box as you see fit. As culture changes, you can change things. You can be as idiosyncratic as you want. You can make up whatever you want as long as you put it in that box and call it tradition. It's defended. And you do that. You enforce that tradition concept with the authority and the power of the church, and that's what they did. The power of the keys, right? The power and the authority of the church. And you can add and take away from it. You just open that lid, you throw it in. Some papal infallibility, boom, it's in there. It's tradition. Marian dogmas, boom, put it in there. Open that lid, it's tradition all of a sudden. And then defend tradition. Don't defend Marian dogmas, defend tradition. Defend the authority to do it. And they never have to show there's historical doctrine in there. They never have to defend it from the Bible because it's tradition. And that's the thing, right? Tradition. And look here in the Bible. The Bible talks good about tradition. It says tradition's a good thing. It's spoken of positively. So submit to that tradition. And if you don't, then we'll use the power of the keys to excommunicate you for not holding this tradition the Bible talks positively about. And oh, by the way, there's no salvation outside the church. So you better submit to it. You see how that concept of traditions can be twisted to become traditionalism. Now, when the Bible talks about tradition, it's talking about like Christian love and the doctrines it actually teaches. That's the tradition it's actually talking about. And it does speak negatively of tradition several times. In fact, more often than it speaks positively, but you know, you can cherry pick. But you see how powerful that can be for an authoritarian church. Well, the Anabaptists come along and they like that black box with the label tradition on it. They love that box, but they don't like what's in it. So they open it up, they dump everything out. But they're like, hey, this box though, that's a pretty nice box. I'm going to keep that box. And they take it and they just start putting in their own stuff. They dumped out the Pope, they dumped out the Marian dogmas, and they dumped out, you know, the magisterium. But they operate with their own magisterium. And they start inventing their own traditions, putting them in that box, and they treat it the exact same way because look what the box says. It says tradition on it, and tradition is good because the Bible says it's good. So do it. And if you don't, you're too proud and you're rebellious. You might not be a Christian. In fact, we might exercise the power of the keys to excommunicate you. And by the way, there's no salvation outside of this group, in this church. There's no salvation outside of it. So they do the exact same thing. They just invented new idiosyncratic traditions. Like, hey, you can't have a beard. No, you have to have a beard. You can't have jewelry. You have to marry in our church only. You have to dress this way. No, you can't wear colored shirts. No, you can't use technology. No, you can't have two pins in your collar. Your hat bill has to be straight. Unless you're a Hutterite, then it can be a curved a little bit. You know, you make up anything. Your jeans are worldly. And those khakis you're wearing look too close to jeans. The inseam that are on your khakis, I see that same inseam on jeans, and that's worldly. So don't you dare wear those to the singing, because that you're clearly proud. You have a hard heart, and you might get kicked out of the church. I mean, make up anything. Put it in that box. Defend it. You don't have to defend it from Bible. You don't have to show that it's scriptural. You have to defend the box. And the church authority enforces that box. That's how it works. They did the same thing. They parallel Roman Catholicism. Covered a lot of ground, but they're right there next to them doing what they did with the Pharisaism. You know, you have to pray this way. You have to live in our community. You have to wear these kinds of dresses. You can't do this with the civil magistrates. I mean, again, you can go on and on. You can't have buttons on your clothes. You have to have hook and clasps only. You can't take pictures. You know, that's vain adornment if you wear that sort of thing. That's a graven image if you have a picture of your family in your house. The list goes on and on and on, but you have to submit to those traditions. And look here where the Bible says tradition is good. So, they did the fundamental same concept of traditionalism as the Roman Catholic Church. They didn't reform away from it, they just reformed the traditions to be different traditions. And it looms large. So yes, the Anabaptists are less formalized in the way that they mimic Roman Catholicism this way. They don't have, you know, big books on it and hundreds of years of it developing into that, but they never abandoned the medieval air. They just mimicked it. They elevate their man-made laws to the same level as God's laws, but they don't even begin to grasp the audacity of doing that. Like, we look at that as a serious thing. Like, you cannot make something up and equate it to what God says you have to do. That's a serious error. They don't even begin to grasp that. There really are two postures that tradition can bring. One is Catholic, in the sense of unifying, universal. Again, small c Catholic. And one of them is schismatic. Your tradition can bring you into the Christian history and Christian faith, or it can make you distinct from it in a schismatic way where it creates division. And that's what we see happening. It can unite or it can divide. And Anabaptists have used their traditions to be extremely schismatic, even amongst themselves. I mean, the things that you will see Anabaptists divide over, it would make you laugh if it wasn't such a serious thing. because it can be so incredibly arbitrary and meaningless. But they'll divide over it. They will divide and divide, and those divisions will divide. And I mean, I could tell you story after story of how this has happened. And most of the Hutterites are because of Jacob Hutter, and Jacob Ammon is the Amish, and like, those divisions happened because of silly, stupid things. And I'll call it that because that's what it is. Hopefully that's not an ugly word I'm not supposed to say. I remember I was in one of Dr. Renahan's classes on seminary. He quoted, and he adamantly agreed with John Owen, saying that Christian liberty was the second principle of the Reformation. And that's really, I mean, at first glance, the Anabaptists, they look like they're all about Christian liberty, right? Leave us alone. Let us practice our liberty. But in the end, they don't practice Christian liberty because they implement a mutant version of it that ironically paralleled the Roman Catholic Church that they despised so strongly. They're no less dogmatic about their traditions that they invented ex nihilo from Roman Catholicism is, you know, the way they are about theirs. Because Christian liberty was meant to be a way to protect the church from man-made inventions and worship. That's what Christian liberty was all about. Protecting the church from the church making things up. Protecting the people from the church making things up and implementing it on them. And that's not what they did. They did the exact same thing the Roman Catholics did. And it has not been applied. Their idea of Christian liberty is not applied to individual Christian conscience. It's really not. It was meant by the Reformers to be a restraint, and they have used the same thing to be insular, be withdrawn, and be authoritarian about their traditions. So they've ignored the restraint, and they've imposed their own version of traditionalism. I think one of the reasons that the early Anabaptists may look unrecognizable in the face of the modern image is because we have of this, like the Amish and the old order Mennonites and stuff like that. Is those traditions took time to develop. If you look at them in the 16th century, you don't see Amish and Old Order Mennonite. It took time to develop into that. But the trajectory for it to become that was set back then. So it was almost inevitable. Their mentality and their priorities were established then that developed them into that. And that's, I guess it's only fair for some of the Anabaptists again, but that's what I cover a little bit right now. I want you to see how diverse they were initially, how that junk drawer label applies. And I thought we'd get here a little bit sooner, but I guess here we are. I just want to cover a few of the good Anabaptists before we take a break. We're going to take a look at the Swiss Brethren and Michael Sattler, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll get into some of the uglier sides of the early Anabaptists. So the Swiss Brethren were... They came up in Zurich under Zwingli. They were reforming right along with Zwingli in the 1520s, mid-1520s, and they were known as the Swiss Brethren. And there were other fanatical Anabaptists in Germany that Luther had to deal with, like the Peasants' Revolt and the Peasants' War and Thomas Munzer and stuff like that. I think I'm going to have to skip past them. But there were three main figures amongst the Swiss Brethren. It was Felix Manns, Conrad Grebel, George Blaurock. These are the guys that came up under Zwingli. And we're reforming, right? They're part of the Reformation in Zurich. And we presume that they were reforming and going along with all the stuff that was happening, which was generally good in that city. But then, you know, they're questioning these practices, and they start tearing stuff out of churches, like the pictures and the organ and things like that. And eventually it comes to baptism, and these guys are like, hey, we don't see this in the Bible either. And Zwingli, I mean, you told us if it's not in the Bible, let's not do it. Well, let's stop doing it. And well, Zwingli doesn't really know what to do with it. At first, he's kind of like, oh, I don't know. He's kind of sympathetic, like, let's talk about it. But eventually, he's like, oh, I can't go along with this. And he opposes them. And he like, on behalf of the city council, kind of argues against them. And it becomes this illegal thing. And they try and force the Anabaptists to stop being Anabaptists, which they started calling them that right away. I mean, the baptism they were practicing, they would like wet a rag and wipe their face. Like that's kind of how they baptized each other. So it wasn't like immersion. They weren't Baptist in that sense. But they try and impose these civil things against them to stop them. And it's just, it doesn't work, of course. And then when they keep doing it, they sort of have to follow through with these laws that they made, almost like Nebuchadnezzar. You know, he's like, well, I don't want to punish Daniel, but here we are. What do? You know, I made this law. And they're kind of stuck in that sort of situation, and persecution starts, suppression starts. And it's violent, and it's horrible, and it's unjustified, and it's a smear. I mean, it's a blot on the history of the Reformed Church, or the Continental Reformed, at least. So Conrad Grebel, he leaves. I don't know if he got kicked out necessarily, but he leaves Zurich, and he preaches surrounding areas, but he gets arrested, and then he escapes a few months later. But he dies of the plague in like 1526. And this is all happening in the mid-1520s. Felix Mons was one of the first ones martyred in January 1527. So again, you hear those dates, it happened pretty quick. He received what was sadistically called a third baptism, which was you were drowned in a river. So they would tie you up, put your hands and your knees together, and they'd put a stick between there, and they could hold you under the water, and once you're dead, they could pull you out a little bit easier. And they just drowned you in the river like that, and they called it a third baptism. They're being kind of sadistic that way. Blaurock was with him. He doesn't get drowned. He kind of gets driven out. I'm not real sure why he was allowed to leave, or, you know, he gets rearrested and rebanished over multiple times. So it's sometimes it's hard to tell why one of them is killed and why others are just beaten or driven away. It's not super clear. But 1529, he became a pastor of a church, and their previous pastor was burned at the stake. And then later that year, Blaurock is arrested, tortured, and burned at the stake by Roman Catholic authorities. So Roman Catholics killed a lot of them, really. It's hard to feel anything but sympathy for these guys. These guys were, I mean, they were different. They weren't in, there's no record of heresy amongst them. They just seemed to be like discovering credo baptism. And that was the big thing that set them apart. So it's hard to tell. You know, it really is kind of hard to tell, but it's hard to have anything but sympathy for them because of this. So I always wonder, like, how useful to the church would they have been had they been given the freedom to mature in the Reformed faith? If Zwingli would have, like, taken them under his wing, defended them, and helped them along in certain ways. Not that they should have, gone along with infant baptism, but mature in the Reformed faith instead of being pushed to the outskirts where they kind of, the tradition begins going off the rails. They don't have time to go off the rails. They all get killed too quickly, honestly. But you almost wonder, would they have developed in a sort of Reformed Baptist? They had the Reformed roots. They were becoming Baptistic, at least in terms of credo baptism. Could they have developed into Reformed Baptists? We almost could have found our heritage there. It could have been like a Puritan-like movement amongst the Reformed, and that could have potentially spread throughout Europe. So there's a bunch of what-ifs that go through my head about them. It's really hard to tell, though, on things like justification by faith alone. What did they believe about it? You know, you don't find a lot of writing or speaking about it. You kind of assume, like, if they're with Zwingli and they're affirming that part and they're not battling about that, then, okay, they must have believed it and understood it. But why don't they make that part of their tradition? Why didn't they bring that in and make that such a distinct doctrine? Why didn't they see the importance of that? I don't know. I don't get it. And maybe they would have if they had time. It's really hard to tell. I mean, I believe many of these guys will be in heaven, these early guys, these very early guys. I think they'll be in heaven. And we can ask them. And, you know, the funny thing is, they might be side by side with the people that killed them. Because I think they're both Christians, and they made grave errors. But they're going to be restored in this perfect union. And maybe we'll have these conversations. I don't know. I got a lot of questions, though. They seem to have, these three men seem to have some association with some another important early Anabaptist named Michael Sattler. And he's really important. He was a former monk. He had briefly visited Zurich, and after he left his German monastery in 1525, again, pay attention to those dates. I mean, these are just tiny snapshots, flash in the pan, early Anabaptists. He's best known because he wrote the Schleitenheim Confession in 1527. Schleitenheim Confession is one of the rare confessions of the Anabaptists, and we'll talk more about it tomorrow, I believe. It's not actually a full confession. It's kind of like, these are seven distinctives we believe, and they kind of leave everything else out. His life as an Anabaptist is short, though. He leaves his monastery. He was the prior. That means he was second only to the abbot, and he came to Zurich in 1525, just as these Swiss brethren are kind of coming online as Anabaptists. And he seemed to abandon his monastic ideas rather quickly. He studied the Pauline epistles. He comes out of it, he gets married pretty quick, He's expelled from Zurich, though, right along with the other Anabaptists, and he goes to Strasbourg, and in Strasbourg, he's received in the home of the reformer Wolfgang Capito. And with Capito is Martin Bucer, who you guys may have heard of. And these are good reform guys, and he's received into them, and they have all these interactions with him. And that's really interesting stuff. But in 1527, just 2 short years later, he too was captured by Roman Catholic authorities in Austria. He's going to be the last guy that I cover before we take a break. I'm so sorry that this is going so long. But at his trial, he's captured by Roman Catholics, and he's mostly charged with these heresies against the Roman Catholic Church, which are not heresies. And he says, well, show me my error from scriptures. And they're like, well, no. The hangman, he'll debate with you. And so the soldiers, they're guarding him, and they're mocking him as they're waiting for the verdict, and it's returned in like an hour and a half. It didn't take long. And they read the verdict, and it said, Michael Sattler shall be committed to the executioner. The latter shall take him to the square, and there first cut out his tongue, then forge him fast to a wagon, basically tie him to a wagon, and there will be glowing iron tongs. So this is the thing that they did. They put iron tongs in the fire until they're glowing red hot, and twice tear sides, pieces of his body. Then on the way to the site of the executioner, 5 times more, as above, and then burn his body to powder as an arch heretic. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church does not mess around with their executions. They exemplify horrific barbarity. There's a low-budget movie called The Radicals that tells the story of Sattler and his wife. It's really interesting. If you want to watch it, it's really low-budget, but it's hard to find, so if you want to link to it, let me know. But it's one of those that has like really rosy treatment of the Anabaptists. But throughout this drawn-out execution, Sattler reportedly was preaching to the crowds throughout it. He knows what's in store for him, but he's preaching all the way to his death. Even after they tear out his tongue. And he asked the crowds to intercede for the judges. You know, they judged against him. And they're present there, and he addresses those judges directly. And they tied him to a ladder and threw him into the fire. And as he's, like, being burned right before it, he prayed, Almighty eternal God, thou art the way and the truth, because I have not been shown to be an heir. I will, with thy help on this day, testify to the truth and seal it with my blood. And as he's burned, he prays and he sings. It's a rough one. It's a rough one to read about. And his hands were tied. And after a while, the ropes that were binding his hands, they burned through. And he's able to raise his hands, you know, they give that traditional sign of peace. And he did that, I guess, with some of his last power. And he finally prayed, Father, I commend my spirit into thy hands. And brutal execution. And then 2 days later, his wife is also executed, though they mercifully drowned her. But you can see this narrow window of time that all this stuff happens very early on. It's, you know, within just a few years, these main figures are dead or gone. They're the earliest recognized Anabaptists, really, and they're all dead in just a few years. And you see a lot of these deaths in the 1520s. A lot of barbaric ones. And it's not like Sattler. It's not real known what he believed, what his views of the actual gospel were. He was more of a holiness reformer, which, of course, it was needed. You know, he saw the immorality and wanted holiness. And we know that Bucer and Capito that he interacted with in Strasbourg, they said positive things about him. He also seemed to be aligned with the Swiss Brethren, and they were probably pretty orthodox, and there's some virtue there. And it's hard to say, though. It says, like, the Global Anabaptist Mennonite Encyclopedia says things like he questioned the Lutheran doctrine of justification and also held works to be important to man's salvation. Okay, well, what does that mean? That raises more questions than it answers, right? I mean, why did they say that? Why did he disagree with, what did he disagree with specifically about the Lutherans got justification right. So what issue does he have with Lutheran justification? And what's it mean that works are important? Okay, well, yeah, they're important. Well, in what sense? As a sign that you've been saved or to get saved? That matters. That's a big difference. So we have all these questions about it. I mean, we don't necessarily know. It's unclear, and it's really frustrating to hear that. But these reform guys, it said that they had discussions in the spirit of brotherly discipline and peace. So they got along, They didn't agree. They acknowledged they didn't agree, but they did get along. And Capito said this of Sattler. He said, "This Michael is known to us here in Strasbourg, and he was somewhat an heir." So he writes a commendation of him, essentially, I think after he got arrested at one point. I don't know if it's to the Roman Catholics, but he's like, "He was somewhat an heir, which we showed him through the scriptures, but since he saw a lack in our preachers and preaching of the true doctrine, especially on the outward life of the congregation," you see that, he recognized the lack of holiness amongst the church and the people, he saw that, he perhaps paid less attention to our admonition. But at the same time, he showed such great zeal for the honor of God and the church of Christ, which he would have pure and blameless and without reproach to those who are outside. We never censored this, but praised it highly. And they said, yeah, we agree. We see this need for holiness. We agree with that. So they're saying, yes, we praise that. We didn't censor him in that way. But his method and the articles of faith we always kindly rejected. And that after much mature reflection before God. Now, we did not agree with him herein. He wanted to pay attention to this. He wanted to make pious Christians through a fixed creed and outward compulsion, which we considered the beginning of a new monkery. But we desired to correct the life of the believers through consideration of God's good deeds, which he has shown us in body and soul, that it might be a fruit of love and gratitude. For this is the way and the order of salvation. You see that. They all see the lack of holiness. Sattler says, we've got to compel them. We've got to use this new monkery. And they're like, that's law. We prefer to develop that through their gratitude because of what we tell them of what God has done. That's gospel. The Reformed got the gospel, and the Anabaptist wanted the law. And they're using it differently. That's the problem. That set everything in motion for the whole history of the Anabaptist right there, 500 years ago. It was that misunderstanding between law and gospel. They used the law where you're supposed to use the gospel. And they did it out of frustration. They did it because of that lack of holiness, you know. But Bucer said this, though, of Sattler. He said, "We do not doubt that Michael Sattler, who was burned at Rottenburg, was a dear friend of God, although he was a leader of the Anabaptists, but much more skilled and honorable than some." So he's saying, like, he's one of the better ones. We get it. We believe he was a believer, but confused. And that's, I mean, it gives me hope. It gives me hope in him, at least. So again, like others, the specifics of the doctrine in regards to justification, salvation, they remain ambiguous, and we're forced to leave it as this open question. We can be optimistic with him, I think, but it's this open question.